The Supreme Court heard oral arguments last week on the constitutionality of Mississippi's ban on abortions past 15 weeks in the Dobbs versus Jackson women's health case. 26 states are poised to ban abortion in some form if the Supreme Court upholds the ban or decides to overturn Roe v. Wade altogether. So, Mike, let's start with the Mississippi case and the legal arguments presented before the court, and what you see as some of the critical issues here and the critical legal arguments.
Well, Jen, the Supreme Court did not really leave us in suspense. There's really no doubt that they're going to overturn Roe v. Wade. The five Republican-appointed justices made it very clear that they want to abolish any constitutional right to abortion that was established nearly 50 years ago. Kavanaugh framed it as an issue of neutrality, that the Constitution's neither pro nor anti-abortion, and that it should be left to states or individuals or Congresses or anybody other than the court.
And yeah, let's talk for a bit about the importance of a federal law as opposed to pre-Roe v. Wade. Abortion was legal in four or five states, starting with Colorado and then New York, Oregon, closely after that, before Roe v. Wade decriminalized abortion. And in many states, you could go before a panel of doctors and make a case for therapeutic abortion. If you had a medical issue or rape or incest or said you were going to kill yourself or your children, so you had to have a sad story. So a profoundly important part of the abortion rights movement was that this was a decision women could make, that you didn't have to have a sad story and come before a panel of patriarchs to authorize your decision. And some of the worry now centers on how much rode on Roe v. Wade, how much was invested in it. But what do you see the legal arguments that were critical? I mean, obviously the Constitution doesn't talk about abortion, but there's a 14th Amendment, the 9th Amendment. There are a number of amendments that do grant personal liberty and restrictions from state action that interfere with privacy. That was one area of legal argument. And then the other was, does a state have an interest in protecting the fetus? When is, you know, the issue of viability that was first framed in terms of the trimesters, three trimesters, then in a later case with Planned Parenthood versus Casey, it was more around viability, fetal liability. Do you see any of the grounding of Roe v. Wade and this new decision around the Mississippi case as similar in terms of the constitutional grounding of the reasoning of the justices?
Well, we have a kind of negative image of the rights that you've referred to. The concept of viability is going to be abandoned by the majority. Even Justice Roberts, who's tried to do a compromise that would accept the 15 weeks but uphold the right to abortion before that, was ready to jettison the concept of viability. He said 15
weeks. Which usually puts that at around at least 24 weeks. And of course, there's also the question of a living fetus, a child that also has a number of anomalies requiring care. So there's never been a clear boundary around what constitutes fetal viability.
Well, Roberts wants to cut the whole idea loose. He said 15 weeks is plenty of time for a woman to make a choice. That's the important issue. But he was getting no takers, because it's clear that five or maybe even six of the justices are going to completely reject the notion of bodily autonomy, the right of privacy, the right of a woman to control her own body. And they're going to frame the issue as a matter of neutrality, that they're going to say the court is not going to pick a side on this socially contentious issue and let everybody else decide, everybody else being the states or the counties or Congress. They clearly believe that abortions are bad. And what's going to happen, I think it's clear, is that we're going to get a decision that's going to be five or six people supporting it. They're going to hold that advancements in the law of adoption and giving up children protect women's equal participation and in the work life and economic life after childbirth, that these developments have eroded the value of Roe. It'll say that these decisions were terribly wrong because the Constitution is neutral on abortion and that the Supreme Court is being democratic and it's making a fair compromise because they're not requiring abortion bans, they're simply permitting them. And that's what's going to happen.
You know, it may be obvious, but can you remind us what's important about federal laws and versus the calls for states' rights? And of course, that was a very big part of the struggle of the civil rights movement and Brown versus the Board of Education was states' rights to define and defend segregation versus federal laws that force states in compliance with national legal rights of people.
Well, a federal law, a constitutional right, is something that prevails regardless of a temporary majority. It's essential, for example, insular minorities like Black people, who are never going to be a majority, are protected by a federal constitution. Rights such as the right to bodily autonomy, the right of women to do what they will and to treat themselves how they want to treat themselves, are rights that were seen in Roe v. Wade as fundamental. That is, rights that cannot be overridden by a legislature or a democratically elected body.
Yeah, and I mean, there was a memory of a progressive era, a very short-lived progressive era of Supreme Court decisions during the social movements of particularly the 60s and 70s. But the lessons here related to turning to the Supreme Court also weigh heavily on us, even though you're saying on the one hand, it's very important what happens at the federal level. On the other hand, there are limits in what we can expect, particularly from the Supreme Court.
This is a reminder that for most of the Supreme Court's 200-year history, it has been profoundly conservative, and it cannot be relied on. So I'm going to ask you, Jan, I know you have thought a lot about this issue. You even made a movie about these brave doctors providing abortions in places like Oklahoma, where they don't have the consensus of support they do here in Portland. What do you think this is going to mean politically?
I mean, the film also follows some of the history of Roe v. Wade as a compromise decision. And even Justice Ruth Ginsburg, before joining the court, had criticized Roe v. Wade decision for ending a nascent movement to liberalize abortion law through legislation. And in the film, we drew out this line of argument that Roe v. Wade was as much about a doctor's freedom to practice his profession as he thinks best, you know, making the best medical decision, and the idea that this is a decision between a woman and her doctor. It wasn't centered as much on women's right to bodily autonomy, and the privacy aspect of it got framed often as privacy between a doctor and his patient. It didn't grant women access. I think on the positive side, the abortion rights movement has overall moved from pro-choice to taking up the critiques of the reproductive justice movement. Black feminists have had a profound effect on expanding our call for abortion rights to include the rights to sexual freedom, the rights to bear children and raise them in a healthy environment, to be supported and sustained in other aspects of health care and economic rights. Even Planned Parenthood, that's tended to be fairly conservative and defensive and narrow in its approach to abortion rights, has adopted the reproductive rights movement, reproductive justice campaign.
Well, that's essential, don't you think? I mean,
yeah.
The Hyde Amendment, for example, meant that abortion was optional. It meant that poor people could not get an abortion. So that completely removed abortion from the role of a medical procedure. like knee replacements that everybody was entitled to, and made it something more akin to a facelift, a luxury that rich women could support and have, but that poor people were not entitled to. That was actually embraced by people like Biden and Al Gore during the 70s, 80s,
and a lot of the Democratic establishment, and even mainstream pro-choice organizations, didn't fight that very much. And even though, like in Oregon, dedicated funds in many states make up for the lack of federal Medicaid dollars that come in, there's also, I think, potential here for a widening and a more radical social movement around reproductive justice that goes beyond Roe v. Wade and pins less of our hopes to paving that road. I mean, it's important to acknowledge the loss and the profound attack it represents on feminism at base, as well as poor women and women of color who are less apt, as they've always been, to be able to travel someplace to get an abortion. Before Roe v. Wade, taking a flight to California was called the non-family plan, where you took a flight to California to get an abortion, and it was pretty common. And I think there's more recognition now of how the intersectionality of these issues, how the same movement that fights abortion also fights against regulation that would make our air clean, the rights of parental leave. But this point that adoption is a reasonable alternative to ending a pregnancy is so obscene in its implications. Forcing women to carry a child and forcing motherhood. And that was a big part of the argument early on of feminism, was rejecting mandatory motherhood, which is part of what it means to be forced to carry a pregnancy against your will.
You know, 75 times more dangerous in Mississippi to give birth than it is to have an abortion.
Yes.
The Supreme Court raced right past that fact and then kept trying to frame it as a women's health issue or a fetal health issue.
Yeah. I mean, one reason I focused on abortion providers, the history of struggle within the medical profession and among doctors, and how they fight abortion stigma in their own profession, the role of women and feminists coming into the medical profession, is that the medical profession since the late 19th century was very involved in the criminalizing of abortion and has had an important role in the policing of this issue and did benefit from Roe v. Wade. But I think now there has been more support for abortion training, making it a mandatory part or expected part of OBGYN training. And so it'll be interesting how the healthcare field responds to these restrictions and how organizing around this develops over the next year.
Yeah, well, don't you think the role of medical providers is receding? I mean, now with abortion pills, isn't that a technological variation there?
Surgical abortions will need to be around, as Sarah Prager says in the film, as long as women are getting pregnant. I mean, there are some advantages of surgical abortion in terms of it's fast. If it's accessible, it can be done very quickly. Medical abortions can be drawn out more. They both should be available, but I don't think medical abortion is a substitute for or reason to downplay the importance of surgical abortions, which means you go someplace, you have a procedure, and then you leave and it's done. So a lot of women can't take 3 days off of work to have someone with her where she expels the pregnancy. So I do think both are important, and that there are communities that develop around the feminist model of healthcare. You know, we filmed in a number of clinics around the country, and these are also places for training and where people talk about their bodies and their experiences together. So that has been also a part of the feminist legacy of healthcare that we need to defend. And it's very patient-centered, and a lot of those principles are, I think, evident in the film Our Bodies, Our Doctors. I hope people check it out. These people have a lot to say, to speak to the moment, the dreadful moment we're in. Well, we'll stop for today and continue to follow the road ahead for Roe. This is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the Supreme Court and oral arguments earlier this month on the Mississippi ban on abortion and what we expect to happen politically.